Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. You can get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy, and you can find Golf News Net on your favorite social media service at the handle Golf News Net. All of our work's on our website, golfnewsnet.com, or you can download our video channels for your Roku TV and Amazon Fire TV players. We are presented by BetDSI.com. They have been in business paying winners for more than 20 years on their A-plus rated sports book with their beautiful, easy-to-use mobile interface. They have odds on everything golf, matchups, props, wins, in-game action. They've got odds on pretty much everything else too, including all your major sports, politics, reality TV, WWE. And you can use the promo code GOLFNEWS25 to get a free $25 wager just for registering. And if you decide to deposit, you'll get a 200% bonus match on your money. So head over to BetDSI.com, use that promo code GOLFNEWS25, and get your free $25 wager as well, that your 200% extra bonus when you deposit. Okay, so first of all, it's great to do a weekly show that's actually weekly. We haven't necessarily been the best at that of late. But well, our guest this week is Kyle Thompson. And many of you probably know who Kyle Thompson is. Kyle Thompson is on his third stint on the PGA Tour. He won earlier in the Web.com Tour season in 2017, actually the kickoff event in Exuma. He did that in the craziest of conditions. I think I've maybe ever seen a tournament complete 72 holes. Shot 76 in the opening round, got interviewed because he had a good round relative to his peers, shot 370s in a row to finish it off and win at 2 under par. So an incredible achievement, and even still, having won that event didn't necessarily guarantee him a place on the PGA Tour, played well the rest of the year, and got himself easily into the 25 for the regular season money list, and now is once again on the PGA Tour. We spoke last night, so we're recording this on a Friday, October 27th. We recorded this on Thursday night. He had shot 75, first round at the Sanderson Farms. Not every pro is that approachable, but he was great. We spoke for, I want to say, a half hour, but you'll see it in the end. You'll get to listen to it all. And we had a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking to him. He's got a great candor about him. He's got a great way of just plainly explaining what he thinks and not hiding anything about it. And that's why I really enjoyed speaking to him. Also wanted to say thank you to the folks at Chase 54, who are the primary fashion sponsor for Kyle, for setting this up for us. That we have some of their apparel in my closet, and I love wearing it. It's comfortable. It performs well. It's great. And you'll hear Kyle mention that at the end and me piggyback a little bit on that, probably a little awkwardly, but I did want to give a shout-out to Chase 54 for making that happen. That's in a little bit. Before we get to that, I wanted to bring up something that has got really grinding my gears. It's fortunately become a national story, but it's unfortunate that it had to be a story in the first place. So you've probably heard this, but if you haven't, be prepared to be somewhat offended. So Emily Nash is a high school student in central Massachusetts, and she's on the golf team. And Emily was able to compete with her team in the Central Massachusetts MIAA Division III Boys District Tournament, their individual event that they have in the fall season. And Emily won the tournament, playing the same tees as her male counterparts. She won by 4. Shot 75, 3 over 75, an impressive round. She won by 4. She didn't get the trophy. The kid who won the trophy was the guy who finished 4 strokes behind her. His name's Nico. And because of I don't even know why this rule exists, but let's call it archaic MIAA rule, Emily wasn't awarded the trophy. And that rule says that girls are allowed to compete in this district individual championship, but their scores, their individual scores, are not allowed to count toward determining the champion. So effectively, Emily was putting on an individual exhibition. But making this stranger, Emily's score counted toward her school's team score. So the MIAA decided that a girl's score is not good enough to compete individually, or allowed to compete individually, but it can count toward the team. So not only did Emily win and not get a trophy, She also didn't get her team to the state championship because the rest of the team didn't score well enough. And despite winning the freaking tournament, she was also not allowed to advance to the state championship in a few weeks. So she basically put on an 18-hole exhibition, won, and got nothing for it. And the first thought I had was just outrage. I mean, my general view of golf is if you're good enough to be in the tournament, if you qualify to be in the tournament, then you should have a chance to win the trophy. And I realize that we have different populations within golf or within sport or society where we decide we want to create limits and restrictions. So we have women's only events, we have senior only events, we have events for players of certain caliber. But the rules of the event said Emily Nash is good enough to play. If her high school appointed her to play, she could compete. She had to play from the same set of tees, but she could compete. She did, and she won. And because of a horribly antiquated MIAA rule, she basically gets nothing out of it. Now, the folks who were, the tournament director, Kevin Riordan, said he would like to personally buy a trophy for Emily for winning the event, and that she should be the story of the day. Well, she is the story of the day because of the MIAA's dumbass rule. And it would be great if Kevin actually follows through and purchases the trophy for Emily. She deserves one. She won! But I thought the cooler gesture was from Nico himself, who went up to Emily after getting the trophy, which had to feel really awkward for a variety of reasons, but primarily because he didn't win. And he went over to Emily and said, "You should have the trophy because you won." And Emily, classy too, said, "Hey, you got the trophy. That's the deal. Keep it." So both the kids involved did great. They handled it exactly how any reasonable person should and how most people, frankly, wouldn't. So kudos to both of them for handling it the right way. Then the MIAA obviously is under scrutiny for their rulemaking, which, again, makes zero sense. And they were called by Steve Eubanks over Global Golf Post, who was undaunted in trying to get a hold of these people, and TJ Alclair as well from PGA.com, who was equally outraged as I think pretty much anyone who's read this feels about it. Curtis Strange was great about it too. He found out about the story and started the hashtag Emily Won to kind of build pressure around the MIAA to do the right thing and get her some kind of recognition for the victory. And the MIAA avoided Steve Eubanks' calls, all seven of them, until like the eighth or ninth try. They finally responded to him after they responded to TJ. And first of all, if you make the rules, you've got to defend them, right? And in the story, Kevin Riordan, who's the tournament director again, said, I'm just enforcing the rules. I don't make them. That's a coalition of schools and their coaches and athletic programs, and they all decide the rules for each of the sports, including golf. And they couldn't come up with what I felt was a good defense. They just said, kind of, the rule's the rule. We might look at it, but we probably won't. And the most annoying thing to me about the MIAA statement is that they couldn't bear to mention Emily Nash by name. They just said the girl, the student. You know, they used a kind of a pronoun, basically, not a specific identifier. And you know, she instead of Emily Nash. And they couldn't bring themselves to say her name in a written statement, which I find pathetic. I mean, really pathetic. And I don't get the sense. At first, when I read the statement that was given to the PGA, PGA.com, I got the sense maybe they would sense the error of their ways and would do something about this, do the right thing about it, get her a trophy, and then change the rule moving forward, because that's ultimately what we want if you're offended by this. I mean, Emily and her coach, her high school coach, knew going into it that she would not qualify for the state tournament regardless of the result. She knew that. And she still played, and that's fine. She says she was not told that she couldn't win the trophy if she won the thing, which is deceptive. You know, if you're going to do something, if I went to a casino and played blackjack and they told me you can play for money, but if you win, you don't get the money, why would I play the blackjack? I wouldn't. And I'm not kind of trying to equalize or equate playing high school golf for free to betting money on stuff. But that's kind of the idea. You're saying you're welcome to put your heart and soul and energy and efforts into this. And if you win, you get squat. No recognition. There's no kind of name in the record book type deal that you get. Nico doesn't get an asterisk. He's just the champion. And it just is a debacle. And this happens probably in more places than we know. And it's in part because there's this gap in how boys and girls golf are treated at the high school level, at the collegiate level, not as much, but certainly the high school level. And part of that's due to interest. They're usually, in a lot of school districts or schools, there isn't enough interest from girls to form a fully fledged girls team to compete against other girls teams in a district. So they come up with this odd hybrid model where girls can compete with the boys in certain tournaments and for team competitions, but they really only have basically a couple of girls' individual tournaments. They have a regional or district, and then they have a state. And that's really the only opportunities the girls get to compete, individually speaking. And part of that is, okay, we just don't have the resources or the interest combined to make that happen. That's fine. You don't have to have a fully fledged girls tour if there just isn't enough room to make that, if there isn't enough interest to make that happen. But if you're going to accommodate girls who want to compete by saying that they can compete in the designated boys events, then you need to give them an opportunity to win. You need to be able to tell them, if you win, you win. Low score wins. If you compete from the same tees and you beat everybody else, you've won, and we're going to give you the trophy. And that they didn't do that here and seemingly were deceptive in what they explained to Emily and her coach bothers the hell out of me. I believe that the USGA has this right, and the other major organizations in golf have this right. When we talk about the major championships, we talk about the four majors as the men's majors. You know, it's the men's U.S. Open, it's the men's British Open, the men's PGA Championship. But guess what? That's not in any of those rules. If you're good enough to play, if you're good enough to qualify, doesn't matter who you are, you can play. You got to play from the same tees, but you can play. And I think that's the right model. You have your open, what effectively is the open division. Anybody, if you're good enough, regardless of who you are, if you can qualify, you can play. Then there should be girl-specific competitions. For a variety of reasons, we've created a protective class of restricted entry to these types of events, again, based on gender and age, and that's fine. We accept that. That's cool. So if Emily wants to compete against everybody, she can be in the quote-unquote boys event, which really should be the open event. And if she wants to kick some ass against her fellow girls, then she can do that too. And she can take the girls' trophy as well, which she will have an opportunity to do at the district and state level, where she finished, I think, like third and fourth the year prior. So she could easily win those two tournaments and have two trophies. But she should have three if she wins all of them. And this is where golf gets a bad rap. So the reaction pretty much universally in golf, and I've had a couple of people respond, well, she knew what the rules were going into, a lot of, you know, legals. Yes, Emily knew that she couldn't get to states, but she didn't know she wouldn't get the trophy. She probably would have played anyhow because she wants to compete. But that's not the point, knowing the rules going into it. The point is that the rule is dumb, and it makes a sport which already has difficulty in trying to welcome women, welcome young girls to play and not feel like outcasts or being mansplained to them the second they walk onto a golf course. And in this case, the golf is not shooting itself in the foot. It is being shot in the foot by dumb high school administrators who don't understand how competition is supposed to work, and that there is the possibility in golf, particularly at the high school level, where boys and girls can compete from the same set of tees and get a pretty similar set of results if they have the same talent level. Because a lot of these kids are 14 and 15, 16 years old. They're not nuking 320-yard drives. I mean, some of them are, but they're playing AJGA events. Most of these kids are just thrilled to hit it 230, 240, 250, and score what they can. And that is a little bit more level playing field until these kids develop a little bit more and you see more distance gaps between the higher performing boys and the higher performing girls. But at this level, it doesn't matter. So I feel like that there should be some kind of recourse here for Emily where she gets a trophy. Hopefully, again, the tournament director does that. If not, we can rally around her and get her a freaking trophy because she deserves that recognition. And second, that the MIAA gets its head out of its ass and collective heads out of their asses and figure out the simple way to fix this problem, which is to have an open division and a girls division, and that be it. And then you go from there, you have your tournaments, and everybody's happy. And instead, all collective golf is sitting around aghast at dumb administrators making us all look bad to the general public. Goes, there goes golf again, telling women what they can and can't do, and disregarding their ability. In this case, I think pretty much everybody wants Emily to have the same opportunity to compete as every other boy who was in that tournament, and lost, by the way, by at least 4. I mean, some of those kids were putting up like 105s. Come on. I mean, I know high school golf's a weird animal, but 100 in a tournament? Come on. Before we get to Kyle Thompson, let's take a quick word for these messages. All right, welcome back, everybody. Kyle Thompson, as we mentioned at the top of the show, is on his third stint on the PGA Tour. It's starting in his second tournament this week at the Sanderson Farms Championship. Spoke to us last night after an opening 75, missed the cut at the Safeway Open. But he feels like he's playing great golf, and he feels like he's playing some of the best golf of his life at 38 years old. And we had a great conversation with him about his experience, how he won on the Web.com Tour in 2017, believing in the decade system by Scott Fawcett, which is a kind of game management, game philosophy system that I think you should look into. It's a really interesting view of golf as opposed to kind of looking at it at a micro level, looking at instead of a holistic level. I think that's an interesting line of conversation that we got into. And also we talk a little bit about the realities of the Web.com Tour and trying to make that a place where guys are more apt to being able to make a living, and as he says in the interview, invest back in their games as opposed to just scraping by and making basically the equivalent of minimum wage and take-home pay after all is said and done between travel, caddies, and the other stuff that comes up over the course of the year. Again, thanks to Chase 54, his clothing provider and sponsor, for making this happen. Enjoy this conversation with Kyle Thompson.
Kyle, thanks for being on the show with us. I really appreciate it. I know you're in between rounds at the Sanderson Farms, kind of getting ready for a Friday tea time. So, first of all, what's it like to go from the sprint that has to feel like the Web.com Tour season to, all right, get your guns ready, you got to go play Safeway, and then you get a few weeks off, and now you got to come back and compete again at Sanderson. What's kind of like that ebb and flow of the year like?
You know, it's good and it's bad. It's definitely been tiresome. We played a lot of golf into the season. On the Web Tour, I think I played, I want to say, the last 8 out of 9 weeks in a row. So I was pretty fried when the Napa tournament was over. And so, I'm getting older, 38 years old. I would love to take more time off, and I can't wait to have more time off, but I have to play right now, and I need to play well. I need to play well so I can shuffle up and get better status for the upcoming season, or the new year, I guess. So
is it kind of awkward in that you kind of go through the sprint of the web.com tour finals. All the cards are issued, and they go, all right, you can get in the Safeway. And obviously you have the issue with, you know, going into Monday this year. But you go do that, and they say, okay, now you got to take 3 weeks off, basically, to prepare for your next start. Would you prefer to have a chance to play 3-4 weeks in a row right out the gate, or did you kind of appreciate the rest?
No, I loved the rest. I didn't touch a club for 10 straight days. My brain was pretty fried. I'd rather take more time off than I've had. Even 2 weeks wasn't quite enough. So, but, you know, I took 10 days off, and I did some practicing and tried to get my game in order. It hasn't, for some reason, my last 4 or 5 tournaments, I just haven't quite been playing very well. You know, and that's mm-hmm. golf, because sometimes there's definitely some ebb and flow of golf, and hopefully I can get it going here soon. I played pretty poorly today. I shot 3 over, just got nothing going, lifted out everything, and just pretty poor, piss poor, really. But, you know, that's the game, and I know that I'll make most of my money in a few events, and that's kind of the way it goes with this lifestyle of ours.
That does seem to be kind of attractive, the way you play. You play great in 3 or 4 event starts, and you kind of go ebb and flow, and you come back 3 or 4 great ones in a row, and ebb and flow and goes like that. As you've obviously played your golf career over, you know, decades, mm-hmm. have you become more comfortable with that? That is the reality of who you are. You're not someone who's going to, let's say, be Tyrone Bass weekend, who makes 20 cuts in a row but finishes T40 every week. You're going to sprinkle in 2 T3s, a win, and then 4 missed cuts.
Yeah, that I have no problem with that sort of golf. I get to see a lot more football in the fall, which is great. And but, you know, it's not that I ever give up. I work hard, and I never quit. You know, when I won in Exuma this year, I was 6 over through like 7 holes. I never gave up and turned that tournament around to win. But sometimes it's strange for me. I missed 7 cuts this year by a shot. And, but when I'm on my game and I'm in contention, I take pride that I can close it a lot of times, or finish right up there in the top, you know, 5. So, I really don't let a bad round or a bad week or 2-3 weeks of golf get me down. I'm kind of like your consummate gambler. It knows that I can strike oil at any time. So that's the way I look at it.
Exuma was a fascinating tournament. It seems like a fascinating venue just because of all of the calamity that's available there with the wind and the way the course is set up. Like you said, you opened with 76 and you shot 3 straight 70s after that and won on, what, 2 under par. So what was that tournament like relative to your other web.com tour wins, 3 at Rex Hospital, and what did you learn about yourself in the process of doing that on a really difficult set of conditions?
You know, it gave me confidence that I can play in any sort of weather. I mean, it was the worst weather I've ever played in. I think 7 or 8 holes into the tournament, I'd already lost like 4 or 5 balls. We had to get more balls at the turn to make sure we didn't run out, you know, on the back 9. And, you know, I get interviewed after the round, shoot 76, I get interviewed, you know, not for good golf, which is insane, but I can't even describe the weather. I asked an official, I said, what are we doing out here? We shouldn't be playing. But had they pulled us off the golf course, we would have never gone back out, because 4 straight days of that, the wind never let up. I've never seen anything like it. At night, it blew even harder. I mean, your ears are ringing all the time. Like, you just felt like you're in a you know, wind machine at all times of the day. So, it was just insane. And I played really solid. I putted, it's probably the best I've ever putted. The wind was blowing like crazy, but my putter was wobbling all over the place going back. But for some reason, I was able to get that ball to leave straight off the face where I was aiming. And, you know, I putt with the claw on the holes around the ocean where it's the windiest. I putted back to conventional style in those holes just so that I wouldn't, like, hit the ball with my putter trying to get it behind it. So, you know, it was just a real strange week. You had to be real creative. There's a par 3, he's playing 108 yards, 109 yards, I think, to the front pin, and I was hitting a 6-iron, you know. Like, you just can't. you can't practice that kind of crap, you know? Like, so it was just, and then I think two holes later is a par five, and I'm hitting a five iron from 260, and it gets on the green. So, so yeah, the way I looked at it, it was just fun. You know, I didn't let anything bother me, and I just said, you know what? We're just going to roll with the punches here and do the best we can. And I made seven doubles for the week and still was able to come back, come out and win the golf tournament. And it was just really, really wild, wild week of golf. So.
Is there, you mentioned kind of craftiness and being able to roll with it. Do you think the younger you would have been able to handle those conditions as well as you do at this point in your life? Or would you have handled things differently when you were, let's say, your late 20s or even mid-20s?
I definitely think the experience paid off. I mean, I've played, I don't even know, a couple hundred events on the web tour, and maybe 60 or 70 maybe on the PGA Tour. But my younger years, I probably would have gotten really frustrated. I would have complained more, and I would have maybe packed it in or who knows. And I saw that around me. I saw other guys folding because of the weather. And I looked at it like, hey, let's just see how much fun we can have. Let's be creative here. Let's try to rope hook this 8-iron into the wind just to make it go straight, you know? So it was just a crazy week. There was a hole number on the first round, hole number 12 is this par 4, goes along the ocean. Par is a par 4, and the par was a skin up until like 3:15 that day. There was only two pars, I believe, all day on the hole. It was the hardest hole ever. It was like a 7-stroke average that day. So, yeah, it was wild, absolutely wild. But yeah, I definitely think some experience helped me. And you know, I try not to let past shots bother me, and I try not to get too far ahead of me into the future, because that doesn't help you either. So, that's the key to playing good golf is, you know, shrug off the bad shots. And then try not to let the momentum or the future or the angst of what might happen on your next shot, try not to let that bother you too. So the guys that are playing at the highest levels in the PGA Tour, they're amazing at that. And I applaud them for that. I mean, Tiger Woods, what he could do to, you know, make 100 and however many of them. Yeah, it's just my opinion though.
Would you say that, for people who may not watch the web.com tour when it's on TV as much as they might watch the PGA Tour, the difference between trying to play golf where the winning score is often more like 20 under par, Exuma aside, versus kind of a lot of weeks on the PGA Tour where maybe 10, 12 under par is a winning score. Is there a different philosophy that goes into playing those two styles of golf?
You know, I don't think there is. I think you play the same either way. I'm always trying to not short side myself. I'm always trying to hit the ball in the fairway. You know, depending on the course setup, you maybe could be a little more aggressive on your approach shots if the greens are softer compared to being firm. But that's my opinion. If you hit it to the fat side of the hole and your putter's hot, you have a chance to win that tournament. If your putter's not hot and you're still hitting the ball good, you can maybe finish top 20. And then if you're hitting it bad and your putter's not working, you might miss a cut. And that's kind of the way things go, you know. So, you know, and you got to think well. But there's a lot that goes into playing good golf. You got to hit it, obviously, pretty well. You got to putt it, chip it well. And you just got to be mentally sharp. You can't throw away golf shots on the golf course.
What percentage of kind of your good or most memorable finishes, either on the web or on the PGA Tour, did you know you were going to have going into that week? Like, you knew you had it going on Tuesday and Wednesday. It's here. This is going to be a good week, versus maybe you kind of found it somewhere along the way and produced a good finish that maybe you didn't think you were going to have.
You know, there's no rhyme or reason for good golf. One year I was in Minnesota, and on the Pro-Am on Wednesday, I shot like an 80 or 81 and trying. I was hitting it so god-awful, so bad. I finished the Pro-Am. I had to apologize to the guys. I said, guys, I know you guys pay a lot of money to put up the pro. I'm sorry he didn't show up today, you know, blah, blah, blah. I went straight to the range after I played on Wednesday, and that week was the number one ball-striking week of my life. I made zero putts, but I lost in a playoff to Kevin Stadler. And then, you know, so there's one way. And then another way, you know, my last win or two wins ago in 2015 on the Rex Hospital,
tournament, I shot a 61 on Tuesday's pro-am, and you know, and then 63 on Thursday. And so then I knew, wow, something special might happen this week. So, you know, I've had it happen both ways, so I try not to get too excited when I'm playing good or too down when I'm playing bad, because it can come down to like one tiny swing thought or one tiny feel that just feels nice. And then you get a little confidence going, and then, you know, kind of off to the races. And that's kind of the way things can go sometimes. It's hard to describe, really.
So does that, not in a sense make it easier, but make it more understandable when you're on one side or the other of a cut by a shot, knowing it's kind of random in some instances that one thing might go your way or not, and that might be the reason why you have a check or you don't that week?
Totally. I mean, there's a lot of good players on, obviously, the PGA Tour and the Web Tour. And so if you're just a slight bit off on your game, you're not going to make the cut, or you're barely going to make the cut. And part of the way I look at it, if I'm not playing well enough to be up in the top, you know, say 20 to 30 going into the weekend, a lot of times it's not often a guy makes a cut on the number and finishes way up high. It happens every now and then. But
yeah.
For me personally, that rarely happens. And so if I do miss the cut by a shot, I try not to get too down. I try to just tell myself, you know, like for instance, this year in the U.S. Open, I missed the cut by a shot. I birdied two of my last three. Thought I made the cut. Ended up missing by a shot. And but I didn't get down on myself, because in a way I had the whole weekend to get recharged and get after it the following week. And then the following week I lost in a playoff on the Web Tour. So
yeah.
You know, you can't get too bogged down into your results. That's all I could tell your listeners. If you're struggling, you know, it can turn around in a heartbeat.
Is there a different game plan between, like you had mentioned, if you're going top 20, top 30 going into the weekend, maybe it's green light, you're going for the highest finish you possibly can, and maybe even a win, versus if you're below that threshold, but you've made the cut, are you still trying to charge as far up as you can, or is there a sense of not resignation that you won't win, but that you won't win?
You know, I don't change my game plan ever. Maybe other guys do, but I've got a system that I've been using now for the past year or so. A guy named Scott Fox that came up with it called Decade. And
Decade, yeah.
I pick my targets, and I hit it at my target. I just try to input it into my, you know, my brain. All right, I'm going to hit this 3 yards left of the pin, hit it to the fat side of the green. You know, in some weeks the putts are going in and some they're not. And it's hard to describe, but I just don't try to press and shoot at pins either when I'm playing, you know, when I make the cut on the number or when I'm in the lead. Like, it just doesn't, you know, I don't think it works. Because, yeah, a couple times you might stuff it, but then you hit one shot a little wayward and you lose all the shots that you've gained already, and it slows you down momentum wise. That's a huge key to golf, is keeping your momentum. So,
what's kind of your thought in general on the movement toward, especially with the European Tour shot clock event, toward trying to speed up golf? Generally speaking, is that a problem among professionals, or is it more of a perceived problem that, you know, we in the media kind of push a narrative maybe too hard?
You know, I would say there's probably 10 to 15% of players are way too fast, and I would say another 10 to 15% of players are way too slow. And the guys that are too slow get all the credit for it, because they get hammered on it. And I do wish golf was played faster. I have no problem. I've probably been timed less than, I'm guessing, 20 times in my, you know, 13-year career. So, I have no problem playing under the shot clock, but I've played with some guys that cannot pull the trigger, and it drives me crazy. And, you know, I've said stuff to guys before. I'm like, hey, man, you got to pick it up. Like, this is getting ridiculous here. But because it affects everybody. You know, a guy playing slow affects me, and it affects the two groups behind us that are waiting. And it's not fair to anybody to have to deal with one guy's issues. And so, it's kind of my cruel, but, you know, my opinion on that. But, you know, the guys that play really fast, like, there's some guys that play so fast that it's almost the opposite effect, like detrimental the other way. Like you feel like you're rushing all day and you feel like, you know, you're pushing the guys ahead of you, which makes, I'm sure it makes them a little bit uncomfortable. And it creates a big gap behind you, and those guys feel like they've got to catch up. So I've seen it happen kind of both ways.
So, I mean, based on kind of having that 80-20 where, you know, or 80 or 70-30, where most of the people that you play with on the PGA Tour or Web Tour or wherever you play are going at an okay pace. They're not too fast, not too slow. How does that, dealing with that 20 to 30%, does that affect the way that you approach golf either through decade or the way that you try to manage yourself through a round, knowing that you might feel, even unconsciously, like you're either dragging or you're rushing?
You know, I have to be real conscious on those sort of days that if I'm playing with a slow player, and you always know before you tee off if he's slow or not. If I'm playing with a slow player, I'm going to stick to my routine, do my rhythm. And it's a challenge. That's one of the hardest things, I think, playing. And I'll be honest, sometimes if I'm with a really slow guy, sometimes I'll go a little slower so I can get the official to notice us and put us on the clock, because I have no problem playing fast. It doesn't affect me, you know, to play in 40 seconds. So that's maybe a little old man gamesmanship I've done once or twice in my career, but anyways.
Are there other kind of tricks like that that kind of help kind of self-police a little bit, keep things moving along, or just help you competitively that they're not obviously against the rules in any fashion whatsoever, but things you've picked up over the years that maybe help you using your experience to your advantage?
I'm sure there are. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any other instances, but you know, I try to play ready golf, and I try to, you know, knowing the rules can really do wonders for you in this game. If you know the rules and you play within the rules, obviously you play within the rules, but if you know the rules, you can use them to your advantage. And that's a big key that a lot of these younger guys, I think don't do. Like they don't even know how to take a proper drop, and they have to call an official for everything. It drives me crazy. Yeah. I'm like, come on, man, you're on the cart path. It's not that hard to figure out, but, you know, they've seen so many bad rulings that have affected people from winning tournaments and all that on TV. I think everybody's a little gun shy for doing their own, you know, figuring it out themselves. So,
do you think that the changes that are coming, potentially, should say, are coming to the rules of golf in 2019, do you think that will help players be a little bit more self-sufficient in giving their own rulings and just kind of moving things along a little bit faster?
You know, honestly, I haven't looked at all the changes. I heard about some changes that were being kind of tossed around, and I don't know if those are full-on coming into play, but a few of them I didn't agree with. I don't remember exactly what they were, but, like, being able to drop it 1 inch off the ground sounds really stupid to me. You know, I think you got to keep – you know, it's definitely a game of integrity, but you have to keep it as, you know, above ground – as possible. Like, you don't want to give a guy a chance to be a little bit on the border, you know, to be in the gray area. That's my opinion. So
the USGA annually gets hammered or peppered because of, obviously, they and the RNA administer the rules, and, you know, everyone just kind of throws up their arms and go, oh, it's the rules, well, we can change them. But there's occasionally the call from a professional that says, hey, you know, the PGA Tour should write its own rule book, and we should follow that, and just kind of chuck the USGA's rule book out the window. Is there – what's your sentiment on that, first of all, and do you think that there are a reasonable number of professionals who think that maybe have never said anything about
it? You know, I personally would be fine with that. The way I look at it, the PGA Tour, they run the most high-quality events week in, week out on the planet, and they've seen every rule that you could possibly see over the course of, you know, all these events. And, you know, the USGA a lot of times are made up of guys who work a real job and they do this kind of as a hobby, you know. And you know, I think if you let the professionals do it, and I think you'd have a lot less discrepancies in the rules, a lot less issues with stuff, and You know, the USGA has been amazing for the game, but I do think that there's better ways to probably to handle a lot of these things. It's my opinion, though. I don't know about what other professionals would say, but I feel like a lot would probably agree with me.
One good thing the USGA did do this year, and partially that was under the pressure of PGA Tour players, was bump the purse up of the U.S. Open to $12 million. Obviously, that is a big difference in purse compared to the entire Web.com Tour, which is about $17 million. So is there sticker shock going from playing for $550,000, $700,000, you know, $1 million a week total purse, even on the Web.com Tour finals, to what's this week's purse at Sanderson, $4 million, and that's considered on the low end of the PGA Tour?
Yeah, there's a little, but it's a good thing. You know, it's great that my work and hard work and my wife and family's sacrifice and everything else has paid off so that I can have a chance now to play for these bigger purses and hopefully, get a nice piece of these purses. So that's what we all dream about playing. Nobody really dreams about playing the Web Tour when they get older. It's all the PGA Tour and the majors, you know, like, I'm not knocking the Web Tour. They run an amazing events week in and week out. They're run exactly like a PGA Tour event. The only real difference is it's the purses mainly, you know. And so, I'm pretty fortunate that I'm in a position now that not only can I play for all these purses, but hopefully I can provide a nicer, more comfortable living for my family. I've got three young kids, and we have a lot of colleges coming up here in the next 15 years to pay for. So hopefully I can, play well this year. It hasn't been the start I wanted, but it can all change really fast, like we spoke of earlier.
Do you feel like that there should be more resources, if possible, put into having more purses on the – higher purses on the Web.com Tour? Or are you kind of comfortable with the fact that that is what the Web.com Tour is, developmental circuit, where you're not trying to necessarily make the same kind of living or even close to the same kind of living you can make on the PGA Tour?
No, the Web.com Tour's purses should be a lot higher. And I've been lobbying for that for years. For instance, I'll give you, this year in Lafayette, Louisiana, on the Web Tour, I played really solid. And it's the strongest field of the season because it's the opposite of Bay Hill. I think it was this year. But I played really solid for 4 days. I shot 9 or 10 under. I finished, I want to say, about 30th, and I made like $3,200. And by the time I paid my caddy, my caddy made more money than I did. And so it was just like really frustrating in that sense. If you had that same finish on the PGA Tour, you'd make $32,000. It's basically 10 times more. And I'm not saying the Web Tour needs to be anywhere near the PGA Tour, but at least you should be able to, if you make a cut, you shouldn't lose money. And that happens a lot. And, you know, for instance, if you finish 75th on the Web Tour and you keep your web full status on the Web Tour, you've made approximately $75,000 for the year. By making 75 grand, you've probably spent 55 to 60 traveling for the season and paying your caddy. So you're netting like 15 grand. You can make more money working at a gas station, you know, the register, than you can finishing 75th on the Web.com Tour. Now, I'm not saying that it needs to be huge, but I do feel like guys need to at least make enough money so they can reinvest in their own games. Because there's plenty of guys. I mean, Zach Johnson, his first year on the Web Tour, he made $24,000. And thank God he didn't quit golf because of that year. He came back the following year as a conditional status, Monday qualified, won an event, and then the rest is history. And those sort of stories happen a lot. And, you know, if guys were able to make a better living, you know, I think it would do nothing but benefit in the long run, benefit the PGA Tour. That's who's making the most money off of the production of the good Web.com Tour players coming up.
Do you feel like, what's kind of been the response, not necessarily having to name names, but what's kind of been the response from the PGA Tour to your overtures or other players' overtures? Hey, we would like to, instead of making 75 grand at number 75 on the web list, maybe make 125 so I can at least have $60,000 I profited from the year and you know, make at least a modest living for the year.
Right. You know, we've been beating the drum for years. Their response, you know, I was ahead of the pack board on the web tour, but their response is they want to grow the events organically and have more events, which we used to have like almost 30 or 31. Now I think we're finally up to about 26, 25. So they want to have more events and then hopefully over time push those purses up from the bottom up. But, you know, I know the PGA Tour has a lot of money sitting in reserves that it wouldn't take a whole heck of a lot to bump our purses up to, you know, $750 a week, something like that. It doesn't have to be outrageous, but $750,000 a week instead of $550,000 a week or whatever we are most weeks would make a significant difference by the end of the year. And, you know, I think it prepares a lot of guys to play more, you know, better golf on the PGA Tour because you're playing for more money. Money means more. So,
Ultimately, over the course of, like you said, what, 25, 26 events, $250,000 an event, it's really not that much money at the end of the year. I mean, it all together really is, what, $4 million?
Maybe,
$5 million.
$4 million, which is like, you know, half of one of their purses. And, that's my opinion. Like I said, I don't know if the guys on the PGA Tour, the big shots would appreciate that. But, you know, Jonathan Bird, who's played many years on the PGA Tour, he came back and played the web the last 2 years. And he told me, he said, Kyle, we got to get off this tour. It's like a slow death out here. when you have a family like we both have, it's, you have to play so well, really, really well to make a profit. And thankfully last year I had a good season. I made like $270,000 or so, and that was useful. So
it's a good year. Yeah. What we talked about this at the early part of the conversation about the reshuffle, and I don't know that every fan, probably people listen to the show might understand it because we're all golf geeks, but maybe they don't. What's the importance of the reshuffle? This first reshuffle, obviously, you get a bunch throughout the course of the season, but how important is this one relative to the others, and what is the approach? I mean, is it just cram as many events in as you can get into and kind of roll the dice?
Yeah, basically, you want to play as much as you possibly can because, you know, we are playing against guys that are getting free money a lot of events. You know, there's guys that play in the World Golf Championships, guys that play in these really small events like Memorial and Bay Hill, small fields that are getting basically free money, the Masters. And it's really, you know, those guys, a lot of them, if you finish last, you get like 50 or 60,000. So we're kind of behind the eight ball coming out of the web tour. And you have to play extremely well to finish in that 125. And so the better start you can get, and the better you reshuffle, the more starts you'll get next year or, you know, come January. So every event in the fall is very crucial. And, you know, obviously the more events you get in, the better chance you have of making money. Because most guys coming out of the web tour, none of them are going to get into Phoenix. Hardly any of them are going to get into Riviera. None of them are going to get into the Players Championship, which is the largest purse. So it's, you know, you have to play well. You have to play really, really well to get a car, which I think it's around $800,000 you have to make. So imagine making $750,000 and losing your job is kind of crazy. So
as compared to making $220,000 in the web.com tour and coasting into a PGA Tour card.
Exactly.
So it's kind of the reshuffle, basically setting your ceiling at, you either got to win to get into kind of invitationals and kind of get off of the reshuffle, or you're going to face events that probably, I know this is going to sound crazy, but the highest purse you're going to pay for it or play for is like $7 million instead of $8, $9, $10, $12 million.
Is that
an annoyance? Is that just an obstacle you've kind of come to accept? And how do you kind of take that on with this being your third PGA Tour season?
You know, I'm just grateful that I get to play out here, and it's the best tour in the world. I don't care if it's for $2 million or whatever. I'm
way I look at it is every week I get a chance to try to win a golf tournament at the highest level, you know, and if I play well, then eventually I'll get into those bigger purses. And all the guys that are in those big purses, they've come through the same way that I have at some point or another. So, and, you know, they've kind of earned that spot. So they, a lot of times the rich get richer, but if you play well enough, you can get into that upper echelon of the PGA Tour. It's almost like there's a PGA and a PGB Tour in a way. And right now I'm kind of on the PGB Tour. I want to work my way up in the PGA Tour. So, but, no, you know, I'm kind of joking, but there is a slightly different level, of purses, like you mentioned, but, you just kind of roll with the punches, do the best you can. And hopefully by the end of the year, it all adds up to another full season on the PGA Tour.
Well, after this week, we got, three events, full field events, well, mostly full field events, down the rest of the stretch. Kind of what are your goals? Kind of keep in mind what we talked about earlier with Decade, and what are your goals for these three events that are coming up, and what then you kind of do in the, I guess, 30, 40 days that you have, until the calendar turns to 2018, and then kind of wait up until Sony.
Well, my goal is, as it is every week, is to try to win a golf tournament. I've got my hands full here, considering I shot three over today. But, you know, I just want to go out and play the best I possibly can. And if it's to shoot three over, that's fine. If it's to shoot six under, that's fine. So, you know, I try to approach every event the same and try to make it not too important and not too, I guess, dire or whatever, you know. But I do understand the importance of playing well. And so I just want to do the best I can. And if I can somehow have a great finish this fall, that'd be awesome. But if not, I'll just get ready and get going next year. And my, you know, month and a half or so off is going to be just loving on my kids. I feel like I've hardly seen them lately. I've got an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 1-year-old. And I plan on bringing them out on the road a lot next year with me. So I'm just going to, you know, be a dad. It's hard sometimes. This job is really brutal on families. So nothing better than being a dad and, you know, FaceTime a lot when I'm on the road. And it's trying to stay connected.
And we really appreciate you taking time out of all the stuff you're doing, including trying to be a professional golfer, to talk to us at like 10 p.m., on a Thursday night to tell us about what you're going through and what you're experiencing. We really appreciate it through the fall and into 2018.
Yeah, thank you. There's a lot of people don't understand this crazy game. Hopefully I can kind of help you enlighten them. And I'll throw a quick plug out to my clothing sponsor, Chase 54. I've been wearing them now for a year, and they're awesome. And if you get a chance, guys, go pick up a Chase 54 shirt. I think you'll love them. They're really comfortable. But yeah, just going to do the best I can, and hopefully it'll be good enough to see me on TV a little bit. That'd be cool.
We're all rooting for you. We appreciate it. And yes, thanks to Chase 54 for making this happen. The clothes are fantastic. I have a bunch in my closet and love all the pieces that I have. So I'm trying to hack around, break 80, playing golf while you're trying to shoot 65s and kick the ass into the world's best golfers. So thanks again for coming on. We really appreciate it.
You got it, Ryan. Thanks for having me, buddy.
Thanks again to Kyle Thompson for being a part of the show. Had a thrill talking to him. Just an enjoyable conversation. He kind of took my lines of questioning, which aren't always the most direct to get to the ideas that I want to approach, but he was great. Tremendous insight into what the mind of a professional golfer looks like and the demands of the profession. So I hope you enjoyed that. I hope it was a little bit, as he said, a little bit educational, a little bit eye-opening into the realities of being a touring pro and how hard it is and all the demands that come with it. So thanks again to Kyle. Next time on the show, we'll talk a little bit about the end of the Asia Swing with the HSBC Champions. We'll talk about the Sanderson Farms Championship a little bit. We'll hit the reset button when the European Tours, they get ready for their closing stretch of three tournaments in Turkey, South Africa, and Dubai, which is a lot of mileage, and we'll get through any other news in the world of golf. Be sure to give us a 5-star review if you have a chance. when you're on iTunes, if you listen to us that way. Helps us reach more people. Just go to our podcast page, hit 5 stars, and we will love you forever. If you leave a comment, we'll even address it on the show. If not, then give us your feedback on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy, on Twitter at Golf News Net. Love hearing what you have to say, guest requests, show questions, all that kind of stuff. And keep on the lookout. We are premiering our new fantasy golf and betting podcast next week. So that's going to start with the resumption of the full PGA Tour schedule in the United States. And we'll go through 3 events with that and the finish of the European Tour season as well. Then we'll take a little bit of break for a few weeks, and then we'll come back in 2018. So we're going to do that as a live video show, and then we'll make that available as a podcast as well. So we're calling it the $4 show. So we'll tell you a little bit more about that on our website at golfnewsnet.com. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. We appreciate it. We appreciate everything you've done for us this season and your support over the years at Golf News Net. And we'll catch you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.